within hours and days, you're suddenly having to make these decisions that are just surreal.
Yeah, making funeral arrangements for a gal you thought you would be planning a wedding for. You know,
yeah.
It is staggering. Hi, everyone. You are about to hear a deeply personal conversation with a dear friend of mine who is working her way through grief and has written a really powerful book about it. But before we get to that, I have another book note to share with you. If you haven't picked up on it yet, I am a reader. I read constantly, and I know a lot of you do as well. And I love hearing from you. So we decided to start a Bulwark book club. About once a month, I'll pick a book, we'll have a few weeks to read it, and then we'll talk about it. Sometimes we'll have the author on, sometimes we may dig in with another guest or two. We may even feature the occasional movie, as we did the other week with A Man for All Seasons. The main thing is, this is going to be interactive. I'm excited to hear from you and the rest of the Bulwark community. So, my first pick, it is a new book called If I Don't Return, A Father's Wartime Journal. You may know the wonderful author, my Bulwark colleague, Lieutenant General Mark Hertling. He started writing years ago, never imagining it would become a book. The writing began with letters to his young sons as he faced one of the biggest challenges of his military career. So please pick up If I Don't Return at the library or at your favorite bookseller, and then start telling us what you think. Any thoughts, questions? We want to hear all of it. You can do that in the comments section of the Mona Charon Book Club announcement on Substack. It's linked in the show notes for today's show and also pinned to the Mona Charon show page on thebulwark.com. Please get your comments in by Friday, June 5th. I may read some during our discussion with Mark. That will be a members first chat on Monday, June 8th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Say that again, Monday, June 8th at 7 p.m. Eastern. And then we'll publish it as usual if you can't make it that night. Again, all of this is at thebulwark.com. Can't wait to read and interact with you. All right, now on to today's episode. Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. I am going to be honest, this is not a typical sort of arm's length interview. Today, I am speaking with my dear friend, Danielle Crittenden Frum, who experienced a real tragedy in her life and has been able to turn it into really a gem of a book. And that book I have here, it's called Dispatches from Grief, A Mother's Journey Through the Unthinkable. Danielle, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Mona. You grew up with our daughter, Miranda. Our children, I should say, grew up together pretty much.
Yeah, it is. You know, when this happened, it was just such a thunderbolt, such a, you know, terrible bomb going off. And, you know, I, of course, we were at a distance, but I felt it, as I said at the funeral, I sort of felt referred pain, you know, as they say in medicine, you know, it may not be your hip, but it's your friends and whatever, it's a bad image. But let's, for people who don't know what happened, I'd like to just tell the story. By the way, has this been hard for you, all these interviews? Is it?
Weirdly, I've been able, I've had a lot of trepidation about doing them because it's one thing to publish a book like this.
Yeah.
And then go talk about it over and over. So, you know, I say, yes, Miranda died 2 years ago, several times a day. And
yeah,
I've learned now to compartmentalize it a little bit. So there's my private grief and then the public face. But at the end of the day, I kind of drop down exhausted. But yes, but I am able to talk about it. And you should feel free to ask me anything because the frankness of the book about experiencing the loss of your child is important to be able to talk about. So don't hesitate.
It is so raw. It is so true. It is so beautifully done. I really cannot imagine. I can't believe you were able to produce this book at all, and far less under the circumstances. It is it's an amazing thing. And I think maybe a superpower of yours is just your unbelievable honesty and willingness to just do it. Just
sometimes it's not
there.
A superpower, Mona, as you know.
All right. Okay. So let's go back. So what was it? It was 7 years before. So 7 years ago that yes. Miranda found out about the brain tumor, right?
Right.
Okay. So she's this gorgeous mid-20s gal. She has done all kinds of things. She's been a model. She's been a journalist. At one point she was doing social media for celebrities where she had control of their Twitter feeds. And I remember her saying at one point that one of these people that she was working for, and this was in the height of, you know, when everything was so sensitive and you could get a dog pile for saying the slightest wrong thing on Twitter, right? And one of them was not so nice to her. And she said, do they not realize that with a flick of my wrist, I could ruin their career?
It's so true. Yeah, she managed or she could post an awful photo of them on the Instagram. You know, yeah. it was funny.
But anyway, so she's living her best life. And then she suddenly says that she is having some physical problems and she started seeing some white, like floaters or something. Spots. Yeah. And so that, you know, you look into it and it turns out that she has a brain tumor.
Right.
So then what?
Well, it happened just over when she was visiting for Thanksgiving. She was diagnosed with a rare but non-malignant tumor. And I mean, it was so rare that only three of them had been seen since the 1950s. And I did say to her, you know, of course, you would have an original tumor.
In the world of medicine, you don't want to have something rare.
No, and we had to find the right surgeon because what made it rare, it was very vascular. And if it was to remove it was like medically defusing a bomb because at any moment, you know, she could suffer a hemorrhage if it wasn't just carefully removed. But it did destroy her pituitary gland. And for that, you can take medication. And she came out fine. It was a very successful surgery. And the surgeons and her doctors said, well, look, you know, you can live a totally normal life. You just will be taking some replacement hormones and medications and go on, live your life. And so she did. And what her endocrinologists, and she was very dutiful about her health, what her endocrinologists did not tell her is if you get the cocktail wrong, because as you know, there are always side effects to medications. So you want to kind of balance it. So your mood, your weight, all those things. And they didn't tell her that, well, if you get it wrong, you know, there is a chance you could just drop dead. And that's what she did.
Or maybe they didn't know? Did they know that?
I know her endocrinologist was saying she was a little low on one of her meds. And was saying she should up it. But there was never any kind of suggestion that this could be fatal. And so in the middle of the night, February 16th, 2024, she collapsed and died and in her bedroom. She lived at that time, by then, in Brooklyn. And then we got the call the next day.
Yeah. And so you say you entered another country.
Yeah. I called it the alternative universe, that you're suddenly, everything in your life, although it looks the same, is completely different. And although I look the same, I am completely different. And in the book, I liken it to one day you're sitting in your house. You're having your coffee, you're reading the news, you're getting ready to go out and do whatever you're going to do next. And then a bomb hits your house and everything that you knew it is now just a smoking ruin. You know, your family has this big hole blown in it. All of us, you know, my two younger children, Nat, who was 2 years younger than Miranda, so was 30, and Bea, who was a junior in college and actually on a semester abroad, 22, and David, we were all just reeling. And well, you were there. You've been such a good friend, Mona. So you saw it close up, our zombie shocked like states and all the things that you have to go through in those days, the immediate aftermath, that are just so horrible. So 3 days before she died, it was just, you know, around Valentine's Day, she had been sending me a selfie of, she was getting ready to go to some, you know, fun event, and she sent me a selfie of herself. And I said, "You look beautiful. Send me a full shot when you have one." And she said, "I'll try." And that was the last text I had. Sorry, Mona, I think it's because I'm talking to you. It's much more emotional than I've hard to have a facade with you, Mona. And then 3 days later, I'm sitting on a computer with a funeral director saying, you know, what coffin would suit Miranda best? And the contrast is, you know, and it's just within hours and days, you're suddenly having to make these decisions that are just surreal.
Yeah, making funeral arrangements for a gal you thought you would be planning a wedding for. You know,
yeah.
I know it is staggering. And people say, I mean, let's talk then a little bit about what happens with other people in the world, because you talk about this a lot in the book, that, or not a lot, but you mentioned that people don't know what to do. They don't know how to approach you, but some people really do say things that are unhelpful, right? Like, and some of the things you mentioned, like, she's in a better place.
Yeah, the Brooklyn Hotel greeter who was just like, "Well, at least she," like literally like this, "Well, at least she's in a better place. Am I right?" And I was like, "She was in a really good place. She had a nice apartment, you know, near the waterfront of Brooklyn Heights." And even, "Oh, yeah, okay, well, that's good." But anyway, it's when you get transported to this alternative universe. And I do write that you suddenly realize how well populated it is. There are so many people around you walking in grief and sadness. And a lot of them have lost children or, you know, lost someone else through tragedy. And you start speaking another language. And the people who have not experienced this kind of tragedy in their lives, and I mean, like, people, and I have lost parents, and David lost his mother, you know, she was relatively young at 54, but there still seems to be an order to the universe in those types of losses. But these are tragedies that just upend your life and are unexpected. And so people, I get why people don't know what to say. I mean, people don't know what to say. A lot of people don't know what to say in general. Even if your parent dies, they're very uncomfortable with it. But I know, and I wanted to make clear that I knew this came from a good place, except maybe the hotel clerk, you know, well, even him, you know,
yeah,
putting a bright side on things, but they want to say the right thing. They see you in pain. They see their friend shattered, and they want to comfort you, and they want to try make you feel better without realizing that not only you're not going to feel better, but trying to make you feel better is like the least thing you want at that moment. What you want is for people to lean into your grief and just say, basically, yeah, this really sucks. This is horrible. I'm so sorry. Can I get you another glass of scotch? You know, that's what you want. And you, Mona, and some of our other close friends here were so good about it, because the other thing that you want is people just to show up for you, you know, just to go on a dog walk or have coffee and just listen. You know, at times I worried I was becoming this grief bore with my friends, but nonsense. You guys were all so great. You just listened and listened and listened. And that really, really helped. But just having that company was so important and supportive. And as I've also discovered entering this world, a lot of my fellow immigrants, they don't have support systems. They don't have a lot of friends. And it can be really, really lonely, especially as the world moves on, as it does, and your friends move on, as they do, and you don't move on, and you're left to feel, you know, self-conscious, and maybe there's something wrong with me that I'm not getting over this so quickly.
Talk for a minute, if you would, about the Jewish rituals of mourning, because you've talked about the importance of having people around, and I think you agree that the Jewish tradition sort of has the psychological insight to understand the importance of being surrounded by people when you're grieving. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I'm a convert to Judaism. I converted actually when I had Miranda. She and I converted together. She was 3 months old and she didn't appreciate being dunked in a...
I'm sure she had strong views.
She always said she had strong views from the beginning. But anyway, we converted and the first time I really encountered the Jewish rituals of death up close was when David's mother died. As I mentioned, she had been fighting leukemia for 19 years. She was a beloved public person in, you know, we're both from Canada. She was this huge broadcaster and it came as a shock to so many people. And one of the things that you do is sit Shiva, which means for 7 nights, people come to your house every evening. A rabbi usually comes as well. Prayers are said, and everybody in that Jewish way brings food. And when I first heard about this, that this was going to be happening for the next 7 days, by now Miranda was about 8 months old, I thought, this is terrible. Why would you want to have to entertain these people for 8 days? Yeah. And I was really nervous. And in fact, it turned out to be the absolute best thing in the world because that ritual understood that for the first week, you needed to be with people and you shouldn't have to feed yourself. You shouldn't have to honestly get out of your chair. Things are brought to you. People tell stories. It's like a prolonged wake in a way, but it gets you through those first 7 days in a really beautiful way. The other rituals that help, and I don't know what, you know, a lot of people, if you're not particularly religious, whether you're Catholic or whatever, and you don't have a kind of ingrained ritual, and we're not super religious Jews, we're not super observant, but these really guide you at a moment where you, like I said, you're in shock. You don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And the Jewish tradition is to bury very quickly. Like you can't put it off. You can't, you know, Jews do get cremated, but it's not a Jewish tradition. So you can't just send your dead off and, you know, wait for them to come back in a little urn that you then put on a shelf and decide what to do with. You have to have the funeral, ideally within 3 days, bury the body. It's very graphic. It does not turn away from what is happening.
You have to face it. There's no getting away from it.
You have to face it. And then once the body is buried and the Shiva takes place, then you have like a year before you even have to think about putting up a headstone. And that is very merciful because, you know, there's haste at the beginning and there's that company at that necessary time. It also recognizes that you need like a full year, 4 seasons of grief to think about, you know, that task. And then you have another ceremony, an unveiling where mourners gather again and you literally pull a sheet off the headstone, the marker. And in Miranda's case, I had the time to really think and plan what I wanted for her, which was a wildflower garden out near where we've spent every summer since she was born in Canada at our lake, you know, our lake house cottage. And so I was able to do that. And so when the unveiling happened, it was a very beautiful thing. And
it is a magnificent spot. Beautiful. So you did an amazing, amazing job. You've also written recently a really great piece in the Wall Street Journal about something that's unique, maybe to the time we're living in, about having lost someone, which is, I think you might have even used this expression, but like these, because of our devices, because of our digital lives, there are these little hidden IEDs that every now and then just explode. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So when people used to die before the digital age, you know, your possessions were all physical. You had papers, you had books, you had files, you had clothes. And those alone are hard enough to go through. I mean, yeah. I couldn't open Miranda's clothes for 18 months. But what you're not prepared for is these wonderful curated carousels from Facebook that pop up on your phone and you have no control over and say, you know, remember you and Miranda in 2016, or remember this vacation. And then suddenly you're bombarded and, you know, you're just going about your day trying to cope. And then suddenly you look at your phone and I call them emotional IEDs. They just explode and you're leveled, you know, for the next hour.
Yeah.
My car keeps wanting to connect to Miranda's iPhone. And we, you know, you'll do searches in your emails for something. And then suddenly there'll be all these emails from Miranda, and there's her voice. There's her alive again. And it just slays me. But the other point that I made in that article was, so you get all this unwanted stuff that you can't control, but Apple, the phone company, Google, if you don't know the person's password, and we didn't know Miranda's password, although we tried every combination of her dog's name, Ringo.
And dates of birth and all that. Yeah.
All that. And we even had her clue, which was roommate and best friend. I'm thinking that has to be Ringo.
Yeah.
But anyway, we tried and tried. And it ended up that the only way we could access anything on her computer was to get a court order. And they had to be separate court orders, one for Apple, one for the phone company, for Google. And Apple, in the end, only allowed us, after, you know, going to court, only allowed us access to her photos, which was good, and the like headlines of her emails, but no contents of her emails. Like, you're made to feel like some sort of prurient person or sleazy hacker who is just trying to recover your daughter's life that remains now locked in those items forever.
Those digital vaults. Yeah.
Those digital vaults. We never got access to her phone. And I don't think we ever got access to Google. So people have written me and said, you know, I know this hacker, and believe me, I'm thinking of going that route.
You recommended that people get their loved ones' passwords. That is one concrete suggestion, right?
Everybody of any age, it doesn't matter, put it in a file, let people know where it is, and then, you know, it's what you need to do. And if you haven't done it, or if you're older and you have a will, put it in your will, put it with your will. It's so critical.
So then your husband will find out about all your affairs and all that after
you're
gone.
Well, I know, but well, you know, I think we used to find all, you know, go through your parents' old love letters, and it's kind of sweet.
Oh, absolutely.
But I understand. Yeah. And look, you can delete things you don't want people to see, but
right.
But yes, it is a whole other world now. of possessions that we have to be self-conscious of.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit, tell us a little bit about things that did help. I mean, that you have this catastrophic pain, your world explodes, but you found this therapist who did this eye movement therapy. Talk about that a little bit, because it's not that nothing at all can be done, right?
Right, right. So the first thing I did, and I think a lot of people do, is you turn to the grief advice books, of which there, you know, is a universe, a whole library of them. And I went to some of the more prominent ones, and especially Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who writes about the stages, because you're in such pain. I mean, you're not just in emotional pain, you're in physical pain. I mean, I wrote that it felt like there was an ice pick going into my heart, you know, every minute of every day. And your nervous system is off, you're not thinking clearly. You're very vulnerable to addiction and all kinds of things. In fact, your mortality goes up within 5 years of a child, that you're much more likely to die of, whether it's clumsiness, which certainly I had, or addiction, or even suicide. So you want to get help. You want this pain to be at least managed. And I was astonished how hard it was to get that help, that even a very famous grief center here in Washington, D.C., you know, you call up and they're just like, you know, thank you for calling. We will not be taking new patients for 18 months.
Oh,
if this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911.
I must have heard
that reporting 100 times. You know, psychiatric practices, grief specialists, all booked up. So I was getting quite desperate and thinking, because I was, I think, as you know, I was really feeling suicidal, which, as you knew me before this happened, would be the last thing you think I would be capable of. But the pain is that bad that you start to believe or think that it would be easier to not exist than to have to keep existing with this pain.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing, an awful, guilty thing for a mother to think about, you know, when you have two living children and a husband, but that's how bad it is. That's how bad you feel. So finally, I was just Googling and I came across EMDR therapy, which is was discovered started in the late 1980s by a female therapist who speculated that traumatic memories don't get filed the same way other memories do, that the brain actually can't process the memory and doesn't know what to do with it. And so she developed this method originally, and sometimes they still do this, you watch a dot go back and forth across the screen. And in this therapeutic setting, you recount the trauma. So in detail, like as my therapist later explained, she said, you know, the only way to get a song out of your head is to listen to it all the way through. And I didn't know that, but that's, you know, good to know, pro tip. But the same is true with trauma. And then just a few years ago, they were watching this process on, you know, we can now look at it on MRIs. And it was true that when people were asked, you know, remember a happy memory, remember an ordinary memory, and the brain just, you know, worked away. And then when they said, okay, now I want you to think of this traumatic memory, the brain just, it started lighting up in weird places where it wouldn't normally in memory processing.
Interesting. Yeah. Didn't know where to put it.
No. And it meant that the memory or the trauma is ever present. So when you think about the classic case of someone with PTSD, and PTSD is what you have from trauma, mm-hmm. you think of, you know, a soldier back from war, walking along the street, a car backfires, and, you know, there he is back in Nam or, mm-hmm. you know, Iraq. Mm-hmm. So when I would do little things, just ordinary things, like the first time I went into a supermarket, and I just started passing things that I used to buy Miranda in advance of her visits. And I just started to gasp. I couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
I had to leave my cart and I had to run out of the supermarket.
You would have no reason to remember this, but I actually came over that night. The night that that had happened to you, I came over and brought Vietnamese food for the family. Yeah. Bob and I came over and you and David told me that you had had this like horrible thing happen at the supermarket and you were upstairs. I remember that.
Well, what could be more ordinary than going to a supermarket?
And with
a death of a child, like it's not just one trauma, the death itself. You have to work through so many angles of it. So, and by the way, they now use hand buzzers. I use hand buzzers and I do it remotely with my therapist, but apparently the back and forth, whether it's buzzers or a dot, gets, as you describe the trauma, it gets the two sides of the hippocampus working together. And only then can the memory be filed.
And interesting.
What I found in this aspect, like especially in the beginning, in the very early deep grief, that you get, it's very common to be very obsessive mm-hmm. and think, what if, you know, my daughter hadn't stepped off the curb at that minute and came five minutes later, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or what could I have done? So the talking it through on EMDR, that was one of the first things we were able to calm. And it doesn't make the grief go away and it doesn't necessarily make the pain go away. But what it does is allow you, as my therapist said, what we're going to do is have you be able to control the grief and not have the grief control you. And that's what slowly happened over many, many months. I mean, I still talk to her, mm-hmm. But I don't think I could do interviews like this if I hadn't gone through it. So it's, you don't get over the grief, but you learn, I guess, to carry it in a way mm-hmm. that makes it manageable to go on.
So I have a question about family dynamics. And if you don't want to talk about this, that's fine.
Ask me anything.
So people have different ways of grieving. And it's often the case when a family tragedy happens that they wind up feeling a certain amount of resentment against other loved ones because they don't understand the way the other person is coping, or they miss it, or they just resent or whatever. How did you all deal with that? There were four of you. There are now five. We will get to that later.
Yeah.
But there were four of you all dealing with the death of somebody so close.
You know, the children were tight, you know, like everybody mm-hmm. was very close, which was nice, which was good. But it was that analogy I'm being very militaristic, but it's the best analogy. When the bomb lands in the side of the tank, takes out one of its key members, and the crew is just, you know. So there were those early days where we're just reeling. And what was, I think, so upsetting to me was this was the first time as a mother I couldn't offer any comfort to my children. I couldn't offer comfort to David, that I got so consumed by my own grief that I really wasn't able to help. But there was also nothing I could do about it. I was just powerless.
Right, right.
And David was, I think in those early days, he felt powerless too, but he was able to compose himself better than I was. And then Nat, our son Nat, and our daughter B, they had to not just deal with their own great loss, but they have this whole new dynamic. I mean, Miranda was the eldest. She was like their leader in all things.
Yeah.
They now have to create a dynamic, re-knit somehow together. So I can see how families can just fall apart over this. Nat said very early on, and I kept this in my head the whole time. He said, the worst thing we could do to Miranda's memory, is to have it destroy our family.
Yeah.
She would hate that. And so we just through sheer physical effort, made the effort to keep checking in on each other. David, I can see how it can totally end a marriage. Because I think too, it would be quite common for it, you know, if the mother grieving differently from the father. From all the stories I've heard, fathers or men are kind of able to lose themselves more into work, like they mm-hmm. can
compartmentalize.
Yeah. Yeah. And mothers just can't. And so I, you know, you hear stories of the wife getting very angry and resentful, as you say, of the husband because she feels he's not grieving enough. Or you just, as David said, again, early on, when all I wanted to do was be curled up under my bed howling, he said, we can't let each other disappear into our own silos of grief. Mm-hmm. And which is all I wanted to do. And so, you know, I give him so much credit for just pulling me back, grabbing me in a hug and just holding me so I wouldn't, you know, fly away. And then I was able to do the same thing for David, that he would retreat. And often he expressed his grief at 3 a.m. and, you know, I was there for him and sometimes forced him to talk about it because mm-hmm. I felt he wasn't communicating out of fear he was going to set me off again. So
yeah,
it's a very, you know, it's a very tricky path.
It really is.
And it takes a lot of conscious effort at a time where you have no energy to do anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Very, very little wherewithal. So in the course of the book, you mention something that I thought was really wise. You say it's really important not to deify the person who has died. Why did you say that? What goes on there?
Well, this is something I actually learned from David's family. And maybe it's also a kind of Jewish thing that, you know, I never met his grandparents, but I felt I knew them intimately because they were always included in anecdotes and stories and not just the good side of them. They're very funny, often quirky side, their grumpy side. But that's what made them so, that kept them so alive and made me know them and made our children, helped our children know them. And so when my stepfather died, whom we were all very close to, Miranda even especially so, we just found that we just loved telling stories about Pete, you know, that really funny stories, like where he would get up to terrible mischief with the children and drive David and I crazy, but they found it extremely funny. So you're trying to keep all aspects of that person alive. And originally I didn't want to write about Miranda. I kept her out of the first draft because, first of all, I just found it impossible. Like, how am I going to describe Miranda? You know, how do you describe your own child with any kind of objectivity? And then I think you were one of the early readers. Former editor was an early reader. And then you're just like, no, we need Miranda. I need to see and know Miranda. So I wove her in. And, you know, she gave us, as you remember, quite a time when she was
a tough teenager. Oh my gosh.
She was the type of teenager you could lock in a room, strip her of every single privilege, and she'd just go,
yeah,
you know, fine. And
I don't like math.
Miranda, like anything, you know, I wrote about her kind of regal indifference to authority and any topic in school she didn't like, she didn't care about. She couldn't be made or shamed to care about. Like, we'd meet with her teachers and she's very bright. She loved history.
Very.
She loved literature. She was whip smart in her wit and things. But if it came to like math, it's like, and one one day she said to David, and I mentioned this, she said, Dad, I don't see the point of math. You know, I'm going to be an actress. I won't need it. And David said, have you ever heard about residuals? But that was her. At one point we were implying a whole second faculty of tutors just to get her through these subjects, which also proved unsuccessful. So there was a little, I think, point where I think I started to take Zoloft when she was about 16.
it was tough.
And then we got her kicking and screaming through high school. And then she lasted about one semester in university. By this point, she'd finished high school. We had to ship her up to my parents, who were the only ones who could kind of manage her, and got her through school there. She went to a Toronto college for about one semester. But she was so hungry to be out in the world. And she immediately got a job as a booker for a local television station. She excelled at it. And then she went on, she discovered Tel Aviv on a family trip, and she decided this was the coolest place she'd ever seen. She wasn't religious. It was like, you know, Paris in the 1920s, but set in the desert. And there she became a model. She was spotted as a model, and she went to Paris and Japan, and then she wrote about it. She was one of the early, she wrote for the Daily Beast under a pseudonym, where she was very aware of the exploitation of the younger models, of the 16, 17-year-olds who would be sent abroad with literally no supervision. So she was writing about that. And then she moved to LA, which she said, she was in Tel Aviv during one of the intifadas, I think of 2014. So she'd have her hair in curlers between shoots, you know, run to the local whatever bomb shelter.
Yeah.
Then take a selfie, and then here we are at the bomb shelter. And then she'd, you know, run back and get her hair finished and the photos taken. But
amazing sang-froid.
No, amazing sang-froid. She was very, very brave. And then moved to Los Angeles, and she said, Mom, this is like Herzliya without the missiles. I don't even have to barter for a mattress.
God. So there's a story in this book. I don't remember it being in the first draft. Maybe you added it later. Maybe I missed it, but I just love it so much. It's a story. So it's about how to face death, obviously. But you cite Pete, who I knew slightly. I didn't know Pete very well, but Peter Worthington was your stepfather, and Miranda lived with him for a while. So he was like a stepfather to her too, because she lived there for a while. But anyway, he was very close to all the from kids, but he was dying, and he knew he was dying, and he wanted to meet with each one individually alone. And you tell the story that he said to Miranda, well, I'll see you down there. Which is just amazing.
I hope he's not too prescient.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, he had an incredible career as a foreign correspondent. He eventually went on to found the Toronto Sun, the founding editor, amazing writer and columnist, reporter. And he just had this humor. But he also, because of his military, he also grew up in a military family, and he himself went to Korea. He had been a lieutenant, and he could just manage Miranda in ways none of us could. It's like, yeah, I've dealt with this kind of insouciant troop before. And so that's, I think, how she got through school. But to go back to your question about deifying, like Miranda, and I do write about all her amazing qualities, especially as they unfolded as she became an adult. And by the end, she was as much my best friend as my daughter. I mean,
I was going to say that. Yeah.
No one was more fun to hang out with than Miranda. Yeah. And we were very, thank God, we were very, very close. Despite the adolescent tension.
Yes.
But how could you talk about Miranda without talking about that side of her, you know?
Right.
She would just, if you just said, oh, she was so brave, she was so courageous, so thoughtful, like that describes a bazillion people. you know.
Yeah, and also a plaster saint, and nobody's that, right? And it robs them of all their individuality and interest and reality, right?
Yeah, and people have said to me who have read the book, you know, just random people I've received notes from, like, I really love the sound of Miranda. Oh, I really would have loved to have known her and hung out with her. I said,
Yeah. Okay. So your son, Nathaniel, has now become a father. Congratulations. So you've welcomed another family member. How does that feel? Is there any feeling of like, I don't really feel like I can love this granddaughter because I don't want anybody to take Miranda's place? Or, I mean, is that complicated for you, or is it joy, or how does it all feel?
I think one of the things you learn from this type of grief, especially as you move on through life, is you will never have the kind of unmitigated joy you once had, that there's always going to be a shadow over whatever it is. And the main thing I've discovered is you have to kind of learn to be present in a moment. You can enjoy a moment, and then suddenly it's like an old war wound flaring up and you remember, and then, you know.
It's an undertow.
And so, I mean, I'm just overjoyed about the birth of this little girl. One of the poignant aspects of it was, so Miranda was in Brooklyn, and her brother, who had been on the West Coast, and his wife decided to move to Brooklyn so as to be closer to family in general, but also to Miranda. And she loved babies. She would have been an amazing aunt. And they would talk about how Nat was going to push the stroller to Aunt Mandy's, you know, apartment. Yeah. And so I think we all feel robbed of that. But when I first held the baby, you know, as a newborn in the hospital, I mean, it's the most beautiful feeling. But I also just remembered doing it with Miranda. And so it's a very overwhelming mix of both incredible joy and the prospect of new life in your life, and also just that melancholy that, you know, Miranda, this is the first of many milestones she won't be there for. And I think that's very especially hard on her siblings, because as Bea pointed out, she said, you know, didn't mean it quite this way or put it quite this bluntly, but she said, like, you guys only have like 20 years. I have to go 60 years maybe without Miranda, you know, but like, she's going to go through weddings. She's going to, I hope, you know, she'll have a wedding and she'll have children of her own. And the person she always thought would be there to share it with her, it won't be. So it's very hard.
Siblings suffer their own kind of loss, and it's different and can have a long, long tail. I know this because my husband lost a sibling when he was a young teenager.
Right.
It's a very, very different and also very difficult thing.
It helped me when he told me that, and I was able to ask about how his parents coped. And I've had a lot of, emails from people who have lost siblings and say, oh, thank you. Now I understand what my mother, my parents were going through, because, they're suddenly thrown into this, as I said earlier, this caretaker role that they should never have to take on.
For you, you've experienced, I think, the worst thing that can happen to people. I think the loss of a child is what is horrible and beyond other kinds of pain. Like when people say, oh yeah, my grandmother died, I know what you're going through, I think that's just not
my
right.
Cat died.
Yeah, my cat died. Right. Exactly. So it's really horrible. But at the same time, there is a part of us that just clings to life, clings to hope, clings to belief in the value of life. And so, you know, there's a story. I'm no rabbinic scholar, God knows, but I once read about this debate that the rabbis had back in the Middle Ages, you know, about considering all the suffering that
that there is in the world. Should God have created this world or not? And they went back and forth. And, you know, in the end, the consensus was, no, he really shouldn't have, because it's too bleak. And then I think they went back later and, you know, later rabbis said, no, you know, choose life. Life is still good despite everything. And so I guess I'm asking whether you feel, despite this terrible suffering, that you still embrace life and the sense of connection and so on.
Yeah. I mean, I also write about in the book, just these unbelievable, I call them happiness hucksters, who want to tell you that the worst thing that can happen to you in life is really a chance for personal growth. And we're all going to become better people from our suffering. Yeah. And, you know, you think, you know, I was fine before. I didn't need the loss of Miranda to become a better person. But it obviously changes you. And I certainly become more empathetic and aware of sorrow around me. But I was talking to, when you've gone through this, you talk to a lot of other mothers, you get connected to a lot of other mothers who have been through it. And then when someone now next loses their child, you become a kind of intake officer, I think of it as. And yeah. you're at the immigration line to the alternative universe. And so I was talking to one mother telling her what, you know, it was going to be like, and just talking to her and listening to her. And she said about her son, and this is in the book as well, she said, my Sean, I think he died at age 29. She said, I know that Sean's life was a gift, but I also have to remember that my life is a gift. It is a gift to be alive. And that sort of sent me reeling, because here I was, the intake officer, and this was the first time somebody had phrased it the other way. And so it's not enough to live for, you know, to just carry on the memory of that person. It's not enough to live just for others, which, by the way, is the only thing that's kept me going, is the need to be here and love my family. But you have to eventually try and learn to live for yourself too. And I remember, and I'm sorry, Mona, I'm going to get wobbly again, but I've been very, you know, anxious about this book. I've been very divided about whether to publish it or not. And then have to publicize it. And I was talking to Miranda about it in my head, as I do. Yeah. And one time, as just before it came out, I was falling asleep and I was saying to her, well, Miranda, at least this will keep your memory alive in the world. And then suddenly, like a bolt of lightning, I heard her voice and she said, no, Mom, the book is not what's going to keep my memory alive. You are going to keep my memory alive. And you're only going to do that if you live. And italicize the word live, that, you know, I know she wouldn't want me to be walking around like a ghost for the rest of my life. Knowing that doesn't necessarily help, but it's true that whatever we have left, learning to see it, learning to at least appreciate, again, being present in the moments, take maybe, if not greater joy, you much more appreciate the things that are beautiful, that do happen. And I also find myself, and I think this is also common in grief, when you lose someone you love and were very close to, you start to embody a lot of their characteristics in that, their good characteristics. And Miranda had an amazing ability to see right into people right away, just get them right away, and sense if they had, you know, especially given her own trauma, share that trauma, just know them and help them. And so many people after she died came to me and said, I don't know what I'm going to do without her. I mean, who am I going to ask about my problems? And she was just there. She was just a very present friend for everyone who met her. And I find myself thinking a lot, you know, well, what would Miranda do? And so I do it. And that's a part of keeping her alive too. But we do have to figure out ways, and it's slow. And some people never do, by the way. I've heard of mothers who just do stay ghosts. They just disconnect from their whole world. My paternal grandmother lost her eldest son on his first flight out in World War II and drank herself to death. She was one of the people who was dead within 5 years. So there is that strong pull to not go on and not appreciate life. And it really takes a huge effort to remember your own life and the gift of your own life. And as that mother said, it is a gift.
It is. Well, Danielle, you are a gift to me, and I cherish our friendship. And you said nice things about me. I felt during this whole process that all I had was like a garden hose, and it was against a raging forest fire. It felt so inadequate. But if the garden hose did any good, I'm glad.
You were amazing. You know, I also wrote about, like, a lot of people, even people you thought were very good friends, just kind of vanish. They can't cope with it. They're just gone.
And I can't imagine. I just cannot imagine what goes through people's heads. But maybe there's just a tremendous amount of denial. Maybe they think it's catching, you know?
Yeah, no, I did a kind of taxonomy of people's reaction, different types of people's reactions. And one of them was, you're kind of infectious. And they'll corner you and say, how did Miranda die? And you'll tell the story. And then you can see relief cross their faces. Oh, okay. Don't have to worry about that. That rare tumor hitting me, you know.
Oh,
it's strange, but I think there are people who just, and look, they may have their own personal traumas that, as I've learned,
that we don't know about.
We don't know about, and they just don't have the bandwidth. They don't have the capacity, I understand that too.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on having been able to write this book. I do think that for anyone who has experienced this, it will be a tremendous help. And also for people who have not experienced it, but inevitably will in their course of their lives come across somebody who is going through it. And besides that, it is just so compelling. I mean, I couldn't put it down. I've read it twice now, and both times I read it in an afternoon because it is just so, it just grips you. It just grabs you and holds you. So I highly recommend it. And thank you for being here and for doing this.
Well, thank you for being such a cherished friend as well to me. Thank you for having me.